Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and welcome to In the Field, a new podcast from IB Times UK. Each week, we speak to journalists and stringers, activists and aid workers, working at the heart of stories that matter. This week, we're talking about the Philippines, a controversial new president Rodrigo Duterte's war on drugs. As many as 5,000 people have been killed since Duterte took office 5 months ago, shot dead on the streets of poor neighbourhoods of Manila by vigilantes, rival gangs, and, it is claimed, the police. Our first guest this week is Sean Williams, a journalist who recently returned from Manila, where he reported on the murders for a number of outlets, including IB Times UK. Our second guest is Dante Ang, executive editor of the Manila Times, a local newspaper. So, Sean, you're just back from the Philippines. Just give us a little idea about how long you were out there and the kind of stories you were working on.
Yeah, I was out there for around 2.5 weeks in September, and I was trying to cover some sort of more in-depth stories. So, for instance, one of the pieces that I'm working on right now is kind of this hyper-domestic view of one of the slums in Manila that's kind of been affected by the whole drug war, and trying to get a view on how people are kind of handling it from day to day psychologically, and whether they really understand the full gravity of what's happening around them.
Because we've seen, obviously, the pictures we see here, the reports we've been reading. I mean, there haven't been so many recently, but when it was all kicking off with the drug war, the images were harrowing, and it was an incredible story. It seemed to come out of nowhere.
It's been an incredible phenomenon for many different reasons, really. When I went out there, it was kind of in full swing already, and I guess there was a sort of touch of the media circus around it, as grim as that is for such a sort of violent thing to be happening. But it's kind of reached this stage where the people seem to have been completely mollified by the idea of all of this violence happening. So when the numbers kick into like 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 dead, there really doesn't seem to be much kind of popular dissent apart from some media outlets. And on a day-to-day basis, meeting people in Metro Manila, which is where I spent almost all of my time, it's quite astounding to see how people's views are not really changed by the amount of death and violence that's being meted out every day.
So talk me through how you cover a story like that. You know, you arrive in Manila, you check into your hotel, then how do you go about covering the story that you want?
Essentially, in Manila, what's going on right now is there's a kind of standard rotation. There's a kind of night shift, in inverted commas, that people are doing, and you will kind of latch on to the local journalists who mostly are kind of hanging out at the major police stations, whether that's in Quezon City, which is actually the most popular city in the Philippines, or Manila. The way that we did it, and there was me and I think I kind of was hanging around with about half a dozen other people as well. We would go down to the police station around 10 or 11 p.m. And then there would be two or three fixers with links to the local police. And then when we got a phone call or a couple of phone calls from different fixers, people would kind of jump in wagons, vans, cars, and shoot off into the distance. And we'd, sometimes it would be three or four different cars going in different directions, chasing different killings. And that would normally go on till around, I would say, sort of 4, 5, 6 in the morning. So it was quite a grueling experience. I did the night shift around 5 or 6 times. Others were doing it every night because I think they were more on the news side, so they were trying to actually see as much of the action as they could up close. I had the luxury, I guess, of being able to step away and work on my own stuff in the background.
But so you, when you rock up at one of these sites, I mean, that's got to be quite a difficult thing to see, you know, a body in the road. We've all seen the pictures, kind of pusher signs on it. I mean, what's that like as an experience?
It kind of takes a while to set in, really, because I've seen some other situations similar to that. But I think what kind of really was affecting people, and it was affecting everyone that I was around who was working there, was the sort of monotony of it, that the expectation and the kind of lack of shock when you get to, you know, yet another double killing, or you see another body, you know, with blood streaming down the street and families crying. I would say it's the kind of quotidian nature of the death that was most shocking. And also what took a while to set in was the fact that when you do see these killings happening, well, you don't see them happening, you see them very, very soon after, there is no attempt to take witness statements. There's no attempt to kind of clean up the crime scene. The body's literally just pulled onto a stretcher, pulled off, and then that's it. You don't see any more again, and the scene is just swept up, some cases by the people who are living there, and then that's it. And then there's no one left. It's as if it never happened.
And Manila, I mean, Manila's always had its problems, particularly with drugs, with gang violence. But I imagine this phenomenon is a completely new thing. So, I mean, how are the journalists, how is the city dealing with it?
It depends which kind of echelons of the city you're talking about, really, because there is such an underclass in Manila. It's hugely shocking to see. I mean, it's a metropolitan area of, I think it must be over 10, 15 million people. So it's absolutely sprawling, huge place. And most of those people are living in, you know, what we would consider as poverty, slums stretching for miles on end. The way that the media has portrayed the whole situation means that these people haven't really, I guess, encountered it from a human rights aspect. And they're pretty much behind the president because of the kind of how tight his propaganda game has been online and in newspapers and television. When you get up to the higher echelons of society, then there are some dissenting voices. But the way that Duterte has structured his government is that there pretty much is no dissent coming from the top down. It's very easy for him to blame any dissent on a kind of metropolitan elite, which we've heard in the UK quite a bit recently.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not assuming you're kind of an expert in Philippines politics, neither am I, but do you get an idea from being there of where this came from? I mean, where Duterte came from in terms of...
Yeah, well, there are kind of two different aspects to it. I mean, first off, there's his time as mayor of Davao, which is a city in the south, which for years and years was riddled by drug violence. It was kind of run by gangs. And he really did clear the city up in a very violent way, similar to what he's doing now. And he was hailed as a bit of a hero down there. So when it came to the election, he threw his hat in the ring. I don't think many people thought he was going to win because there are a few dynasties in Filipino politics, and it seemed like one of the established political people would win. But what Duterte did that none of the others did was that he mobilized social media and the internet and really just completely blitzed his opposition through there. I think he was outspent by a huge, huge amount by his rivals in the elections this summer, but he took over 40% of the vote. And since then, he's really battened down on this social media and Facebook campaigns. And there really is almost the way that people think about him as this strong man. They've been willing to look past all of the flaws that I guess most people would read about in the Western press. And you barely ever hear anyone talk about that kind of stuff when you're in Manila itself.
It's incredible. You could actually be talking about Donald Trump, couldn't you?
Yeah, it's pretty strange the parallels that you could draw, especially where it comes to Facebook, actually. So in the Philippines, a lot of people have smartphones, but they don't have the money to pay for data. So all they have is the opportunity to look at kind of clickbait articles, but they don't have the chance to actually click through and read them. So what you get on Filipino Facebook is a lot of these really well-organized, hyper-partisan, cobbled-together websites that say something like Duterte hero, you know, kills 4,000 drug dealers, scumbags, something like this. But there's no chance for Filipinos to really dig under the skin of that and see the facts. So, yeah, it's an even more crazy version of what's been going on in the US.
So you mean that they can only see the headlines and they can't click through because they don't have the data to log on?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And that's been a huge, huge driver in the popularity of Duterte recently. And he's mobilized, you know, thousands and thousands of people, some of whom have been paid to disseminate propaganda online. If you go to some of the pages on Facebook and some of the Twitter followers, they have millions and millions of followers. And it kind of becomes a multiplication game where the more people just share this kind of stuff, the more that becomes the de facto, well, the fact, really, of the day.
Yeah. You kind of alluded to the class issue before, but I mean, is there a support for Duterte in that bottom strata of society where these killings are happening? Or is it mostly among the rich and the middle class that support him?
So I spent the majority of the final week in Manila just in one slum because I really wanted to get an idea of this, how your average poor Filipino family or community kind of interacts with this whole situation. And what I found was that it was a very weird cognitive dissonance where they would kind of at the same time condemn to me that the killings, and they would sprinkle in words like human rights and extrajudicial killings into Tagalog, like sort of strange passwords, but they would not go the extra mile and say that it was actually the president's fault. And when you pressed them on this, they would say it was overreach of the police, it was drug dealers offing each other, and they would sometimes say it was the media's fault as well, but then you would find out that they never read the newspaper, they never really look into any stories. It was always because they consume all of their news online or through the television, all of which are controlled pretty much by the government. And so there's this weird sense where they appreciate the strongman attitude of Duterte and that he speaks his mind, as we've heard in America so much. But they don't like the violence, but I think that they don't really equate the violence with him. I think they always try and find a way of dancing around that.
Mm. It seems to have dropped down the kind of news nowadays, I mean, in recent weeks. I guess that's probably because of Trump and other stuff going on, the war in Syria and so on. There's less exposure on it now. I mean, is it, as far as you know, is it tapering off in terms of the killing, or is it just carrying on but no one's talking about it?
I think it's sadly the latter, really. I think it's going to maybe ramp up in the new year when Trump gets into power, because obviously Duterte's been trying to pivot pretty sharply away from the US, been courting China and even Russia for foreign policy and military and all sorts of things. So I think that when Trump comes to power and these two kind of very similar populists clash, then I think you could be revisiting this in a lot of stories. But I think something interesting that Duterte said was that even human rights defenders who get in the way of these killings could be legitimately killed themselves. That's tantamount to kind of condoning a war crime. So I think that if anyone gets in harm's way in that sense, then that could also make the news as well.
Yeah. And you report from a lot of hairy places. You were recently in Afghanistan. In terms of the Philippines, how do you rate that story on your scale of stories you've covered?
I found it one of the most certainly depressing trips that I've been on, because, I mean, not least for the fact that as among the kind of clique of journalists that were going around, you would be up at 8 and not really be going to bed till about 5 in the morning. But aside from that, I thought that like I said, the kind of grim monotony of the whole thing, and the feeling that it is a bit of it's this kind of circus of murder and violence, and no one seems to care. I think that was possibly the most depressing aspect of it. And I rarely came into contact with true distraught people or anyone that was as you would expect in a scene of sort of despair, any of the deep emotion that you would expect that to carry with it. I think that this is just what's happening aspect of it made it even feel even more great.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
From the normal.
Thanks, John. And now over to Dante, who will tell us a little more about how the war is being received by Filipinos. So on the on what's going on in the Philippines in terms of the drug war, you've obviously been back there in Manila since 98. You've been involved in journalism ever since. So has it been a challenge deciding how to cover something? I mean, presumably you can't take an editorial line against or for Duterte. I mean, the man's the president. So how do you deal with that?
It's actually it's a big challenge because it's not a, you know, what I sense when I look at, you know, CNN and the other reports from the West is that it's there seems to be an impression that it's a black and white issue, but it's really quite complicated because some of the killings, you know, you can't really say they're attributed to the government, because the problem with the drug trade is that it has infiltrated even the police.
Right.
So the police, the dirty policemen are allegedly also responsible for many of these killings. So it's really hard to tell if there are, I don't know what the right word is, a legitimate, you know, action by, you know, sanctioned by the government, or if there are dirty policemen and politicians who are trying to erase any links that might connect them to the drug trade. You know, though that's another dimension that's not being really talked about in foreign media, but that's certainly quite an issue for us here, obviously.
A lot of countries have problems with the drug trade, not least the US and Britain. But how big and how endemic was it as a problem prior to Duterte taking over?
Well, you know, prior to Duterte, to be honest with you, even us as very few journalists here really appreciated how big the problem was. And, you know, when it became certain that Duterte was, you know, going to be a serious contender, then we started seeing some of the national surveys asking about this issue. And I remember there was one particular survey that reported that that the drug trade has infiltrated, you know, more than 90% of our villages. Now, the village in the Philippines is a barangay, so it's the most basic political unit.
Right.
And the report said it has infiltrated 90% of those villages. So it's, you know, massive. And, you know, if you listen to the Senate investigations going on today, you know, and the names and ranks of policemen being mentioned, I mean, it's just really mind-boggling.
So is there an element that actually, while we are kind of horrified by what's happening, is it working?
What do you mean? Horrified by the killings?
By the killings, yeah. I mean, you're talking about kind of what, 5,000 people apparently, or close to that, have been killed.
Well, yeah, more than that. I think the number I saw was something like 5,300 or something like that. But actually, that's quite disturbing. It's disturbing in the sense that there's such a magnitude of this problem existing.
Right.
But it's not, you know, on the street level, it's not disturbing in a security sense. I don't know if that's making any sense, right? You don't, you know, people here, at least some of the people I've talked to, and myself included, you don't feel that you are in danger.
Right.
I mean, but what surprises you is that, you know, the enormity of this problem. And then also the numbers of the extrajudicial killings that are, you know, rising. I mean, I think One newspaper columnist compared the number of people who died so far with the number of people who died during the previous administration. So in the first, 6 months of this government, you already have a number that is equivalent or more than the six-year period of other presidents.
Right.
So in that sense, it's the scale of it gives you a sense of the scale of the problem.
But I sense in a column you wrote for us, actually, you pointed out that it's kind of nuanced. I mean, it's not that people aren't necessarily against what's happening in the Philippines.
Well, you know, the odd part is, you know, and this is what most people try to grasp is the government enjoys quite a bit of popularity.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that suggests that, you know, at the grassroots level, there is a sense that, you know, that the problem is a serious one, and that there is I think appreciation on people's part that the government is trying to address it. Now, that doesn't mean that just because they appreciate that the government is doing something, that doesn't mean that they are happy with the killings that are going on. So they draw a very fine line between, you know, how far they think the government should go. So
yeah.
So I think on one sense, people are happy that the government is moving strongly against this problem. But I think there is a growing concern also on the growing list of people who have died so far.
It was interesting you mentioned this before, but when you're walking around the streets of your neighborhood, it's not like you're seeing people being gunned down in the street. It's not
like, you know, not like what you probably associate with Hollywood movies, that there are drive-by shootings, right? You know, people just opening fire on a crowd. You know, what is going on is you know, dead people showing up, you know, in public places,
right,
and dead people being dumped, you know, with some message saying that they were part of the drug trade, or they should, you know, that it serves as a warning to others or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think of the coverage in the Philippines, and as a journalist, I mean, how have you felt about the coverage? Do you think it's getting the scrutiny it needs, or do you think there should be more scrutiny?
What needs to be done is, I think, more sophistication. You know, like I said, I think it puzzles many people, probably even local journalists, how there could be such an outcry against the killings, but at the same time, a high popularity rating or approval rating for the government. So, and you know, that's something that needs to be examined more closely, why that exists.
And in terms, you know, aside from Duterte, what's the feeling kind of on the street about how the Philippines is being portrayed in the international media, or are people not quite really aware of that?
I think among the upper class, I mean, there seems to be a sense of concern, maybe even embarrassment, that, you know, the Philippines is being portrayed in a negative image. But, you know, between you and me, when Trump was elected in the U.S., you know, we were sort of glad that, you know, Duterte disappeared from CNN for a while.
Yeah, of course.
So, but, you know, and until the other day when our president had a telephone call with President-elect Trump. So, but otherwise, I think the masses, they don't really pick up on that.
Well, you were mentioning that earlier, that the issue with kind of internet speeds, and actually Sean Williams, who spoke to us earlier, he was in Manila recently. He said that a lot of people, they don't have internet access on their phones, that the internet networks aren't great. So it's difficult for people to keep up to date with the news.
Well, yeah, I don't think it's difficult to keep up with the news. It's just inconvenient.
Right.
I think, it, you know, for the majority of Filipinos, just like everywhere, anybody else in the world today, I mean, there's a lot more access to news than ever before. I mean, and that keeps the local guys on our toes, right? I mean, because a lot of foreign outfits also do, you know, extensive coverage of Philippine affairs. So, yeah. I mean, quite embarrassing for the local guys to be screwed by the foreign media outlets doing work here.
Yeah, of course. And so just my final question, I mean, where do you see this going? I mean, it's been 6 months. He's potentially got 6 years. Do you think Duterte will kind of maybe calm down, sit back, or do you think this is it now? It's going to be like this for the next 5.5 years?
I don't know him, right? And to be honest with you, I did not vote for him either. But so I what I know of him, I know from following the media just like everybody else.
Right.
And he doesn't seem to be the kind of guy who would change. I think he relishes in telling people that, you know, take it or leave it, this is who I am, right?
Yeah.
And he even brags about not having a desire to hold on to the presidency, and said willingly that he would willingly give up the presidency if, you know, if people didn't agree with him. So I mean, that gives you a sense that he's not going to change.
Yeah.
And what I think, and this is the article that I was trying to develop for you, just haven't had time to sit down on it, is that he seems to be a lot more masterful as a political strategist than he's being given credit for. What I sense personally is that he's playing a high stakes gambling game, right? I mean,
right.
On foreign policy, for instance, you have his moves toward China and his rebuffing of the United States.
Yeah.
Right? And on one hand, you think that's a nationalistic move, and until you remember that, you know, there's a need, number one, to de-escalate the tension in the South China Sea. Then there's also the peace talks with the communists. Those two things are you know, they have to be taken into consideration when you read his moves, even his political appointees. If you really study them, I mean, they're not out of a whim. I mean, there seems to be you know, a political game being played. You know, so it's, you know, the thing is, if he is successful, then, you know, I think people will be singing praises to him. But, you know, but if he fails, I mean, the stakes are so huge. I mean, people start asking questions, you know, like whether or not he would last 6 years. So,
thanks, Dante. We've included rich links to some of Sean's reports from Manila in this podcast, as well as Dante's columns for IB Times UK. So if you're listening on Acast, be sure to go back and check them out. There's plenty more pieces on the war on drugs and Duterte on the website as well. So for more information, go to ibtimes.co.uk. Lastly, if you like this podcast, please subscribe on iTunes and leave us a review. Next week, we'll be finally turning to the US, just over 1 month since the election of Donald Trump. How is America coping with its brash new billionaire president-elect? Until then, take care.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both as twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in...
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional, unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.